Hello, and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast, where your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Andrew Cersini,
and Tosin Anofawakin.
We just watched the seventh episode of Starz American Gods second season titled Treasure of the Sun. We assume that you have as well, so total spoilers to come. Let's dive into the after talk, but before we do, let's catch you up on how to reach us. Here are our online links. You can follow us on Twitter at Gods Podcast or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods. You can write or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. And all of our links are also there as well. And add us on iTunes. And if you do that, please like us and leave a review. That's how we get noticed for the show. Before we jump into our analysis, Dwayne, would you give us a brief recap of this week's episode?
Yeah, you got it. So we start with Shadow finding Mad Sweeney under a bridge. The leprechaun made his way back to Cairo, hoping he'd find Laura after she left him in Louisiana. Having lost Laura and his coin, he's down on his luck. He warns Shadow. They both make their way toward the funeral home. The Yggdrasil tree Wednesday is cultivating has gone from being a potted plant to being a young tree twice as tall as a man. Wednesday says because of that, he's ready for war. Ibis and the Djinn recount who's on their team. Alone, Wednesday unveils his broken spear to Shadow. He cuts a sprig off Yggdrasil and uses it to repair the spear. He gives it to Shadow and tells him to guard it since it's tied to Wednesday's life. We find Laura in Tennessee at a roadside diner where she encounters Mommy G. Laura makes it plain that she's no friend of Wednesday. Mommy G, a.k.a. Kali, reveals herself to Laura, and Laura finds a way to respect her. Laura learns from Mommy G that she's got the power to destroy, and she gives Laura a piece of paper. Laura leaves by hitchhiking. Back in the funeral home, Bilquis makes a risque sermon in the chapel of the funeral home that sexually arouses all of the women in attendance. Mad Sweeney gives her his confession, and the audience is treated to a flashback. Mad Sweeney comes out of his reverie to find himself alone except for Wednesday. They argue, and we learn that it was Sweeney who killed Laura. We also see him try to get out of his contract with Wednesday. Wednesday commands that Sweeney finish off Laura Moon. Banshees seem to come for Sweeney, who recalls a time when he was alone in the wilderness eating ants from a tree. He was a king who abandoned his troops on the field of battle, and when he did, the Christian bishop cursed him to poverty and madness. In a conversation with Shadow, Mad Sweeney lets slip that since Shadow is Wednesday's bodyguard, should Wednesday die, Shadow will have to hold Wednesday's vigil. Sweeney makes a deal with Shadow to make sure that when the death comes, Shadow will stay out of the way. At dinner, Sweeney attempts to use the spear to take on Wednesday, and Shadow intervenes. As the two spar, Mad Sweeney reveals to Shadow that he killed Laura on Wednesday's orders. Shadow stops fighting with Sweeney and moves to confront Wednesday. With Shadow's back turned, Mad Sweeney picks up the spear, yelling as he hurls it toward Wednesday in a killing throw. Shadow hears him and intercepts the spear, turning his body as he deflects the downward force of the object, and mistakenly kills Mad Sweeney. In his final act before dying, Mad Sweeney takes the spear that's skewered into his body and hides it in his hoard, a location that's difficult for Wednesday to get to. And that's the recap.
All right, yeah, that's a great recap. And yeah, I think the bottom line about that is that in this episode we see the apparent death of one of my favorite characters of this adaptation, which is Mad Sweeney.
I mean, he's an incredible character. He's so much better than the character in the book.
Yeah,
right. They take it to a whole new level with Mad Sweeney. I heard, you know, there was some news that Pablo Schreiber got the actor who plays Mad Sweeney got picked up for a role in a different show.
Yeah,
that's happening next year. So I kind of wish that they would wait until like the episode where he dies airs before they like drop that news, but whatever. So he probably isn't coming back, but you know, just slow clap on that performance because it's been pretty good. So that's a thing. That said, you know, it's not unheard of for any show like this to bring an actor back for a guest spot after they've been killed off, right? So the writing isn't in stone on that one. But yeah, it was an incredible episode. That moment where Shadow inadvertently kills Mad Sweeney, you could tell they took forever blocking it. It ended up going in slow motion. There was some CGI. Like, they really had to work that out to make it work. But yeah, it was also interesting considering last episode with Donar the Great, you had establishment, foundation for the spear and its power as Wednesday held it up for to threaten Donar or Thor. You know what I mean?
Right.
So we know that it's a dangerous thing when it's put together. And then once it's put together, we know how dangerous it can be. And then it's kind of like, what did you call it? Chekhov something with the gun?
Chekhov's spear. We knew it was coming back later on. And in particular, like in this particular case where we get flashbacks to Mad Sweeney's backstory, and he keeps getting foretold that his life will end, you know, at the tip of a spear. He's fated to die at the end of a spear. So again, in combination with what we've built up with Gungnir so far, it is like Chekhov's spear, you know, which obviously is a reference to Chekhov's gun, which is a narrative device that originated with the playwright Anton Chekhov, who once said that, you know, if you see a gun loaded in Act One, you're almost guaranteed to see it used by Act Three.
So. Right. Right. So, I mean, it was great. You know, when I used to watch that TV show Lost, there was one moment when I stopped watching it because I was given the backstory of two characters.
Yeah.
And then they were abruptly killed off the show. And that was pretty much the last day I watched Lost. It was somewhere in season two or three.
Nikki and Paolo?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was Michelle Rodriguez and the woman, the blonde woman.
Got it.
Who knew Hurley, right?
Yes.
From the those whatever. Two. So like the difference between this and that was that those were two characters I didn't really know.
Sure.
And they spent 45 minutes helping me know them. And then they killed them.
Right. You know why they killed those characters. It's a total aside, but the reason they...
Well, I know Michelle Rodriguez had some trouble with the law, but I'm not sure what happened.
So did the other actress.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, at least Michelle Rodriguez got a job again. I don't know whatever happened to the other actress.
But you didn't tune in for a Lost Recap podcast. Right.
Okay, so I guess what I'm saying is the difference between that frustration and was that it was definitely more of a send-off. They could have spent more time in Mad Sweeney's backstory throughout the season, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't have to spend 8 minutes, a beautiful 8 minutes, but they didn't have to spend 8 minutes with the CEO and other things like that. At the same time, though, as a something that goes on an actor's resume or reel, this episode is perfect for Pablo Schreiber.
Absolutely.
It's been great. Yes. And the tragedy of who he was, the character, is so real. So I think... editorializing about the episode in general, I just felt like it felt fantastic. One of the things that's on paramount in my mind is the woman who was the actress for the prophecy. Was that the same woman who was his wife in the past?
I honestly could not tell. Because the during the prophecy scenes,
it was dark, and
there were tight shots on them, and I didn't really get a good look at her face, to be honest.
But so. I mean, the tragedy of like, this is your daughter. Why is my daughter in rags? What happened to that yellow dress? All that stuff was incredible.
All right, let's get into our salient points for this episode. We'll start with the title, Treasure of the Sun. Tosin, can you elucidate for us why they called this Treasure of the Sun?
I think there's a few reasons. One of them, of course, is that Mad Sweeney can also be considered a kind of shiny treasure. The shiny one is what he used to be called. But additionally, as you guys kind of talked about, the spear itself is Mad Sweeney specifically called the Spear of the Sun's treasure now, as he... made it disappear into coins and now is putting it in the hoard. So I think those are a couple reasons why it could be.
He's relegating Wednesday's treasure into the hoard, which is in the sun.
Exactly.
I like that. I feel like Sweeney was interesting because one thing that stuck out to me was he's telling a story about a prophecy about him, and he gives what seems to be a prophecy about Shadow. He says, quote, "I'm going to tell you something. This is gallows ground you're walking. And there's a rope around your neck and a raven bird on each shoulder waiting for your eyes. The gallows tree has deep roots, stretches from heaven all the way down to hell. And this is the world, and it, oh, I'm sorry, and this world is the only branch from which the rope is swinging. And that was cool for a number of reasons. He's obviously describing Yggdrasil, right?
Sure.
And he's basically saying that, Shadow, you're in trouble, even if you don't know it yet. The idea of the ravens on each shoulder, obviously, those are the two ravens that fly with Grimnir, with Wednesday, with Odin. And we also know, if anyone's ever seen any kind of fantasy, watch Game of Thrones or whatever, the first thing that happens when someone's hung is the ravens or the crows come and they pick out your eyes of the dead body, right? It's the easiest meat to get to, that kind of thing. So the idea that they're on his shoulders is even more ominous, right? So what's interesting to me also about this moment is that as Sweeney says these lines, the camera pans to an industrial structure behind him, a railroad crossing or a bridge that looms like a giant rusting iron tree. So he's talking about this Yggdrasil tree going up to heaven and going down to hell. And so there's this iron tree behind him. It seems abandoned. There are no workers, no trains rolling by. It's a bit of infrastructure that's possibly no longer in service. And it's a reminder of that kind of thing where we met the King of the Dwarves. Like, this part of the country has a certain hell to it because it isn't the industrial center it used to be, right? These workers were hung themselves. At least they were hung out to dry. And so that language really resonated for me. And for me, it was a reminder that these aren't just the words of any god, but an American god. So the scene, the way it was shot, the mise-en-scene was set up to remind you that even though he's telling the story and he's all this mythical whatever, he's in the heart of America, right? And that was really powerful to me.
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. I really sort of clung to the raven imagery as he's sort of whispering this, kind of trying to hide this away from Wednesday, who's kind of always watching, and this belief that Wednesday and his tasks are leading Shadow to the grave, kind of in reference to the a couple episodes ago when we're talking about Cairo and talking about, you know, the plight of the black man. So
yeah, especially because you know, his ravens are right there, and we know that that Mad Sweeney led Laura to the grave, right? They're disposable. Everyone's disposable to Wednesday from Mad Sweeney's perspective. And Tosin, you want to talk about the ants?
Yeah, so in the same scene a little earlier, you know, Mad Sweeney's kind of freaking out about ants, which, you know, lead to a memory of him sort of eating ants in the beginning.
Chekhov's ants?
Yeah, Chekhov's ants. But we first see them immediately in this scene after he's talking about Laura Moon, about dead wife, and kind of represents getting under his skin, getting closer to the ground, getting closer to death, and becoming one with the earth. But also for him, initially getting closer to his past and his origin story and kind of figuring that out.
There's also something to be said about, you know, the ants on his hands and arm, and then Laura had a fly on her arm. And Mama G, like, went to slap at it. This idea that he knows that Laura's covered in, like, bugs and stuff. And then he's got him on him. Which is, you know, a strange connection.
Dwayne, you want to talk about Sweeney as a fairy?
Yeah, so this is, like, a tiny little moment. But it's one of those lines that the writers just did a great job on. Wednesday basically says, fuck the fairies, to Salim. And Sweeney. And Sweeney turns to Salim and says, "You're going to let him talk about us like that?" Which is just a reminder that as a leprechaun, as the fair folk, you know, Sweeney at 6'5", Pablo Schreiber, he's a fairy, right?
Yeah.
And then fair he's folk. Using the term
indeed
to talk to Salim, who's a homosexual, and he's doing this derogatory joking thing. But at the same time, he's telling Salim that he and Salim are
kindred spirits.
Exactly. So he's both denigrating Salim and saying, "I'm with you. Are you gonna let him talk about us like that?" And that to me was pretty powerful. And it was at that moment he establishes and reminds us that he's a fairy. Soon after that, he's like, "You just ate fairy food. I'm free of your curse, or I'm free of your bond." And if he had just said fairy food, like, "You ate fairy food, you're free of our bond," you know, that is a legitimate fairy tale story, mythology thing. But it doesn't work unless you remind us that you're a fairy first.
Right.
So that was pretty clever. Andy, what were you going to say?
In this episode, we saw Bilquist made a point of changing how she spreads her potential for worship. So, you know, before she had her methodology of getting worshipers was through carnal acts. Like, she would have her worshipers basically have sex with her, and that was how they would worship her.
And then she'd eat them with her vagina.
Yeah, essentially. And so now that those vectors have dried up for her, she's converted essentially to preaching religion to attract worshipers to her, and becoming a preacher, and that's how she spreads her message and attracts worshipers.
Yeah, in my head, I was thinking she was just kind of feigning as a preacher, just pretending to be a preacher. But what I will say is that, in agreement with you, she's got a number of ways in which to gain favor or worship, and it was pretty clear in that episode that, you know, it's all about attraction. So when those men are attracted to her and she eats them with her vagina, she's like directly taking in the attraction, and that attraction is what makes her powerful. In this case, it may not be as creamy or fatty a type of worship, but by getting all those women to be attracted to her, she's also sustained and thrives. So she's got multiple vectors, and that's cool to me because it just reminds us that these gods, who are definitely not mainstream in our society, they have to have these multiple vectors, these different ways of attracting worship, or else they can't be who they need to be. And Bilquist is savvy, you know?
Yeah.
This is a very different Bilquist than in the book, which is nice.
Yeah, I mean, I really second what you said of Bilquist as a religious leader and how she's kind of mixing love into the religious text and getting lovers through church, right? So this is her new way of adapting, as she kind of mentioned to Matt Sweeney, who has had a hard time at adapting and finding his place in this world.
Totally. When it comes to that situation, Mad Sweeney, what do you think about potato salad, Tosin?
Yeah, so I found it interesting that Wednesday was eating potato salad. And for me, I thought that this, you know, it felt like he was trying to spite Mad Sweeney by, you know, using a food that's typically known as being sort of, maybe known as being Irish potatoes, but bastardizing it, right? Changing it into another creation and sort of eating it in front of Mad Sweeney, or you could even imagine it being like eating the fruits of Mad Sweeney's labor and not really caring about the people who created it, right?
He's
taking this away from the mourners and not really caring what their goals were for this. That's the way Wednesday kind of feeds off of everyone, to be honest.
Yeah, he exploits everyone and everything. It's becoming clear. Which is pretty interesting to me. So, you know, Wednesday's a god, not a hero.
Yeah.
What do you want to say about that, Tosin?
Yeah, I mean, Mad Sweeney mentioned this to Shadow. Not all gods are heroes. And this really shows a prevailing theme that we've been seeing of late of, you know, gods and man being more equivalent than before, having similar sort of desires, be it carnal in wanting to be praised and wanting to have lovers, or in other means and how they react and how they have bickering and anger and, you know, just
they're being, petty.
Yeah, being more similar to humans.
Yeah, that's really interesting because a lot of these kind of, you know, what they said, the Mad Sweeney said the Christian God made them small.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these deities that are not the gods that are worshipped today, you know, the Hebrew God, the Muslim God, the Christian God, they are petty and they're very human. And you can tell how their stories were used to help discuss human nature. Whereas the God that the Abrahamic God is not petty. I mean, he's got some vengeance going on. You know, the First Testament, the Old Testament, and all that stuff. But he's decidedly not human. And when he has a son, according to Christian and Islamic belief, Jesus is lauded because he's so not human in terms of his pettiness, right? You slap him, he turns the other cheek. He's like, it's easier to pass through the eye of a needle than to get into the kingdom of heaven with riches. He just isn't petty like that. So it's interesting to see how the story doesn't give up on this idea that these gods and their stories were these kind of petty things that you end up realizing makes them so much different from the gods in the mainstream today. So that was pretty interesting. Speaking of mainstream, we have this great visual moment when Ricky Whittle and Pablo Schreiber are basically standing face to face. After Pablo's like, hey, if something happens, don't get involved.
Right.
And to me, that was really interesting because, I mean, visually, you've got these two guys staring at one another. I mean, Ricky Whittle is jacked, right? He's, you know, he's a show business. He's a very big guy. He's 6'1". He's all muscles. And then you see Pablo Schreiber, and you're like, oh, and Pablo Schreiber is 6'5", and he's all muscles. So yeah. Seeing a person dwarf Ricky Whittle is crazy. And what's also interesting is, you know, the clothes they put him in, Schreiber and everything, he looks gaunt. He looks like he's not standing up straight, whatever. But then you see him in his all of his glory in, like, ancient Ireland, and he's, like, all muscles and 300 and all that shit. And so it was just these really interesting images of him kind of being the man, even though whenever he fights Whittle, he gets his ass kicked. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, there's definitely, I mean, just the physical presence when you see Mad Sweeney in some of those flashbacks in his fighting prime, you're like, my God, that this actor, Pablo Schreiber, he must have just really just worked out and trained himself for this role, for this, possibly for this one moment.
This scene, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there was the sex scene last episode, sure, so it helped, sure, to look good then. But yeah, I think of Ricky Whittle as this muscle bound giant guy, and you see Pablo Schreiber next to him, and it's kind of like that Fast and Furious 5 flick where Dwayne Johnson was there, and he's all huge, and then they get this huge other dude from Europe who's gigantic-er, right. And you're like, oh, there's always someone bigger, right? So it was pretty cool. The visual of them standing next to one another side by side, that was pretty tight.
Yeah.
Tosin, who's the uncertain man?
So for me, another salient point revolves around Mad Sweeney, of course, being this is primarily the episode is based around him. But as you can see in the very beginning of the episode, he is very sort of uncertain and shaken, right? He is not really sure that he's remembering things the right way. He notes, you know, sometimes I remember things one way, sometimes the other. He thought he got killed during a sexual encounter, and we found out that that's not necessarily the case. Anyway, he starts off fairly uncertain, but by the very end of this episode, he becomes a very certain man, right? We kind of already have this glimpse that he's not expecting to last the night. He's not caring about, he tells Ibis, like, he doesn't really care about tomorrow. Although in the you see him drinking throughout the episode, but at the sort of bottom of the bottle when he smashes the bottle at the close to the end, it causes him to remember once he's at the very last drop. And we do see him take another sip of alcohol at the table during the final events, but he seems more sober than he's ever been and more in control And so it looks like this man is ready for the end, prepared for the end, and now also has an understanding of what his past has been and what his future will be.
Yeah, which is also really interesting considering, you know, Matt Sweeney drinks a lot. There's a lot of stereotyping with the idea of an Irish guy who's always drunk, whatever. But his resolution in Breaking Away from Wednesday is absolute, and he goes beyond that. Speaking of Wednesday, another great visual was, you know, Wednesday did call it the Last Supper, but this idea that Shadow and Mad Sweeney are duking it out, fighting, getting bloody, and Wednesday just sits there looking at them eating. Much like, you know,
it was cold, man, to watch that.
It was cold. Yeah, it was totally cold, and it just visually reinforced the man that Wednesday's being portrayed to be, the manipulator in chief. You know what I mean? The guy who's sitting there and getting you to bleed for him while he's, you know, shoving food in his face. It just felt like, you know, it felt dark, you know, it felt dank. Like, if Wednesday was the good guy before, he's definitely falling from that perch in a big, big, big way, which makes you wonder, Shadow, why are you fighting for this dude?
Right. And maybe there will be more doubt to come as we get further into this story.
Gotcha. Speaking of doubts, Tosin, Laura's got some doubts?
Laura does have some initial fears. And this is kind of one of the... There are a few moments where she shows weakness throughout this show, right? Once she's realized that she's kind of invulnerable.
Right, she's irreverent about everything.
Yeah.
She's like, whatever, I got the power.
Yeah, I mean, she does have a bit of doubt at the end of one of the episodes where a Wednesday was trying to convince her that, you know, Shadow was not her treasure of the sun, so to speak.
Right.
But she finally sees Mama G in her full form and kind of gives like a nod of like, okay, I see why you're powerful. I'm not going to like treat you like I treat the other gods.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting to see how she got some reverence for something. Because her whole time, she's been irreverent. She's been like, I'm going to kill myself, whatever. I guess there's nothing sacred. And then Shadow was sacred for a second. And her faith in Shadow has been rocked. And then she's seeing Mama G. And it was interesting how seeing Mama G and talking to her gave her some perspective. Now, we don't know what was in that note that Mommy G gave her, but it'd be nice to find out eventually.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where I wonder if the writers actually know what's in that note, you know?
Yeah. I mean, or I think that the bottom line from that exchange is for Mama G to remind Laura that she is a destroyer also. She has the potential to be a destroyer as well as one who is filled with love.
And as we'll talk about in the big picture, it also solidifies a bit of Mommy G's character that was confusing me before. So that was also helpful there. Oh, and so one last alien point. Sweeney continues to call Shadow Moonshadow. I didn't hear that so much in earlier episodes, but he does it at least twice in this episode, which to me is interesting because Sweeney likes to tell all these kind of like stupid jokes. So there's also like, you know, the idea of someone mooning somebody. But then there's this idea that Laura Moon is with Shadow, right? And because of their connection, there's this idea of like Moonshadow. That was interesting to me. Last thing is that, you know, Mad Sweeney does die, and his luck is, and it seems almost as if he died of bad luck in a way, because Shadow didn't mean to kill him. He just grabbed the spear, and the angular momentum ended up shoving it into Mad Sweeney's belly. And for a guy who's afraid of dying, of what happens when his coin isn't around, that's a real bummer. So
yeah, but kind of interesting that Shadow Moon or Moon Shadow did it to the shiny individual who, you know,
King of the Sun.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a nice connection there.
All right, let's move into some questions. Do you guys have any questions about that were unanswered in this episode that you look for having answered in future episodes?
Yeah, so, you know, we talk about the salient points that are full of things we can figure out or we can pinpoint.
Yeah.
But for me, the questions are pretty important. So, like, Sweeney, right? He's like, "You owe me a coin, Shadow." And it's unclear to me why Shadow owes Sweeney the coin. And I'm assuming he's meaning the coin that's in Laura's body. But if Mad Sweeney killed Laura, why does it matter? I guess that's the coin that Shadow took from Sweeney after that first fight and dropped on Laura's funeral bed, you know?
Mm.
And it kind of burned through, got into her body, and that's why she was alive. So from Mad Sweeney's perspective, Shadow owes it to him. But she wouldn't have been dead in the first place if Mad Sweeney hadn't killed her. So, I don't know. There's that. What do you got, Tosin?
Well, one question I had is, what does it mean that Laura has the power of the Destroyer? We know she's incredibly strong. We know she has the power to destroy relationships. But what else does this mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. But we've seen the Laura's just sheer physical strength before. You know, she warned Mama G that she could, you know, break her, essentially. And we've seen her nearly break other gods as well. You know, we've seen her kick Mad Sweeney's ass left and right. So there's something about Laura in her state that makes her, you know, a formidable foe or a challenger to the gods.
Yeah, it's a great juxtaposition too, because she's this diminutive person. You know, she's walking around in this kind of like Dust Bowl style dress and boots, yeah. Right? Like, there's nothing threatening about her physically, but then she's threatening physically to everybody else. Which is maybe why Mad Sweeney really wants her dead. So that's interesting.
Another question I have here is, what is the job that Mad Sweeney owns Wednesday? Is it indeed to finish off Laura Moon, or is it something else?
I think that was a bit of a side quest. So Laura's a disruptor. She's a destroyer, but she's also a disruptor. Nobody expected Laura to show up. They, you know, basically Sweeney is under the control of Wednesday, and Wednesday said kill the woman. And then Sweeney kills the woman, and then she shows up alive again. So Wednesday still wants her done. And that's one of the tasks that Sweeney has to perform because he owes Wednesday to begin with, not as kind of an end of relationship kind of thing. So I think that's where that's coming from. I'm not really sure exactly why Laura Moon needs to die in Wednesday's calculations, other than the fact that he gets complete coverage of Shadow, right? He's all Shadow has left if she dies. So that was pretty interesting. So question for you guys, this is a little silly,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, we see Salim and the Jinn go off. We see Laura and Mad Sweeney go off. We see all that stuff, but where is Nancy, right? Like, Mr. Nancy was by the, you know, Betty, the car, when the train, just before the train came, he gets out and walks randomly away, and then we don't see him for another episode. And here again, he just isn't really present. So I don't know. Like, where is he hanging out? Is he downstairs in the basement making some new invention? It was strange to me.
Haven't seen him in a little while. So who knows?
Yeah,
exactly.
Tosin, you got one more?
Yeah, final question here is, we see in one of the flashbacks that Mad Sweeney is fighting potentially his father, and then he has this depiction of it kind of being Wednesday or being Wednesday's head. Well, was it Wednesday, in fact, who tried to get him killed and put him into the place that he is today? We know that Wednesday's already battled his other son and is also a one-eyed god. Is this just a...
And we know that Wednesday is a master manipulator, so he could have tried to manipulate it so that Sweeney would have fallen. But I think also it's interesting. You know, Ireland is, you know, nearly at the top of Europe. And when the Danes came, they didn't just go to Britain. They also went to Ireland. So it very well could be that some of Sweeney's tradition came from Norse mythology.
Sure.
And in Norse mythology, there's an All-Father. That's Odin. That's Wednesday.
Right.
And the idea that the All-Father could be Sweeney's father wasn't missed when I watched that. The idea that the Allfather could have been bastardized into these kind of like ruffian dudes. Right.
Just as other religions borrow from traditions from previous religions, perhaps that this is one of those cases where character Baylor, one-eyed Baylor, who was Mad Sweeney's grandfather, one of the Fomorians. Yeah. Maybe that was really sort of a story that was adapted from Norse mythology.
Right. I agree with that. I think that the idea is there's such physical, the physical locations are so close. Yeah. People were traveling back and forth. And if you can have gods coming to America from overseas, there's no way that Ireland or even Scotland would be spared some Norwegian influence. So. Yeah. I totally agree with that. So I guess that's the questions, huh?
Yeah. That's the salient point, visual points of this episode. Let's move on to the big picture section. This is where we talk about how the events in this particular episode impact what we know about the overarching story arc. Dwayne, you want to update us on what we know about the Old God army so far?
Yeah, this story was really, really clear about the ranks of the Old Guard army. You know, Wednesday is clearly the general on top of it. But then Ibis was laying out that in addition to him, they've got Jaqel, they've got Set, they've got Horus, they've got Bast. These are all Egyptian gods. Of course, they have Mr. Nancy, which is a Nancy. The Jinn said that there were other Ifrits magically in Chicago. So, okay, great. The Jinn came from New York City. So you've got these other people coming from Chicago. You've got Mama G or Kali, who's a destroyer. So it's nice to have someone like that on the battlefield. Chernobog with his hammer, he's coming. But there is a complication. Bilquis seems to be a free agent. And that was pretty interesting to me. This idea that Bilquis, for all that she's spending time with these people, she's not really interested in fighting. And, you know, if you're a god of love, a goddess of love, I could see you not really wanting war. I get that. Right. But given her role in the book and given her role in the beginning of part of this story, it was surprising to me that she was a no, I can't do that kind of person. So so be it. Now, Wednesday also says two interesting things about the spear he'll be carrying into these battles. Mm-hmm. The first one is that every life that it takes is a tribute to him. So that's how he gets worship, by taking lives with the spear, or someone else using the spear to take lives for him. And if you read the book, you already know that. But in the book, that's a twist-creating revelation. So it's a really big deal that every time the spear is thrown or kills somebody, that makes Wednesday stronger, right? And number two, the second thing he says that was interesting to me is that he says the spear is tied to his life, which is a clue that lets you know what his weakness is, right? It's also interesting because, you know, how is it tied to his life? We met the spear when it was broken and the runes weren't working, and Wednesday was definitely alive. Maybe not at his height, but definitely alive. So, you know, what does it take to destroy the spear, to destroy Wednesday's life? Like, how do you break the horcrux that is Wednesday, I guess is what I'm asking.
Right. And maybe, and should you, or is there a larger... a larger plan that only Wednesday is privy to, who knows?
And so, yeah, that spear is a very interesting, it's taken a very interesting meaning in the new series as opposed to what it was in the book, where it's kind of basically mentioned, but it isn't a centerpiece of MacGuffin the way it is in the show. Mm-hmm. Tosin, Mad Sweeney and his death.
Yeah, so one of the things that was really unique about this episode is, as we saw Mad Sweeney go from place to place, he kind of goes through this procession of his death, right? He attends a funeral, or sort of a sermon. He then, which is kind of like his death occurring and the occurrence of his death. And then he kind of sits with Ibis and learns what's written about him afterwards, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, the memories of this person who'd passed away. And he also hears the wailing of banshees that he considers the coming of death, but it mm-hmm. also could be they're mourning his life. So it's kind of like he's we know that he dies at the end of the episode, but it's kind of set along the side that we've experienced his death prior to his death.
Yeah, it's pretty meta. Definitely, they were definitely preparing us emotionally for this death, and I think these devices helped us get there.
Yeah, preparing us as well as preparing him.
Right, exactly. No one's gonna say his visual. Also interesting because, you know, the episode opens with him under the bridge, mm-hmm. and you know, Shadow thinks he might be dead, and in the book, he's in Cairo or whatever, and he's pretty much dead as a doornail, lying on the street when Shadow finds him anyway. Yep. So that was a good twist for the book readers. I like that. All right, so we mentioned earlier about how Laura found some respect for Mama G. And I thought that was pretty – it was a pretty cool episode because we learned how Mama G gets her power, right? She's at all these roadside diners across the Midwest, and you're like, what is going on here? They're owned by the Hindu diaspora. And so the Hindu diaspora, people who are immigrating from India, they are – heavily invested in roadside hotels and other things, places where she shows up because of their worship. And, you know, she's kind of self-networked into all of these places. So that's why she's there. I thought that was pretty interesting. Now, she's, you know, Kali isn't always drawn as a middle-aged to late-aged woman, but she's drawn, she is that way. And part of that might be because it's the first generation of Hindu worshippers that come to the country that, you know, worship her and support her, and they're getting older. She makes it a point to say that the second generation kids don't worship her at all, and she hates them for it.
Right.
So she's getting older with her population, while the second generation kids are not at all interested in her. So, like, who knows what's going to happen in the future, which is a great example of the whole, this country isn't meant for gods, right? That kind of thing.
Right.
This idea that you get lost in the shuffle with the next generations who become so American. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But I guess let's get into Mad Sweeney's story.
Yeah. So Dwayne, you want to kick us off for the first part? Here's the thing, is that we have seen I almost knew that this was going to be the last episode that we saw Mad Sweeney in, because I've seen this happen before in other TV shows where just before they kill off this character, you finally get filled in on the full backstory in order to sort of build the sentimentality for this character. And they did it again here with Mad Sweeney, and I could almost predict that it was coming, that we're finally getting filled in on everything, you know, because we've seen Mad Sweeney's story here and there in bits and pieces throughout the first season and this season.
But they get seriously expository here.
Yes. So do we get the full story? And I guess it's a fitting tribute to, you know, this character that we've grown to love in this series. So, yeah. Dwayne, what's
your... A character that was taken way out of... he was grown so much
in the
TV show from the book.
Above and beyond.
The show is better for it. I still think the show has a... You know, the book is a fantastic read, but I do think the show is better, and it's because of performances like Pablo Schreiber's Matt Sweeney.
Yeah, he definitely added to this the potential that the show had. So, why don't you kick us off with the first part of his story?
Right. So he's talking to Bill Quist, and he's like, "There's a girl. I remember that much. She had the sight, and she let me play with her boobies under the stars, and she told me my fortune. Told me I'd be undone and abandoned west of the sunrise, and that a dead woman's bow would seal my fate. I laughed and I poured more barley wine and played with her boobies some more, and I kissed them full on her pretty breasts. Those were the last of the good days. The gray monks were changing our stories, making us fair folk into greedy little green men, which is all fucking bullocks. I used to be, I can't remember. For me, that was awesome. Obviously, it's expository. It lays out who he was before, how he saw himself.
Yeah.
But what I liked about it ended with him not remembering, because he's a drunk and he's not a reliable narrator. And so the whole entire episode kind of goes on like that of, you know, what's real, what's not, what's the truth and what's not the truth, to the point where Ibis has to say storytellers aren't about the truth, right? And we can talk about that a little later, but the idea here though is that Matt Sweeney doesn't quite know what he is, but he knows what he's not. He knows that he's not a greedy little green man who's all fucking bullocks, right?
Yeah.
We know that, you know, with a lot of these gods, like, well, I began losing faith toward the 20th century, whatever.
Yeah.
Yada, yada, yada. He's like, I began losing faith back when, like, you know, 1200, when St. Patrick showed up, you know, these gray monks. And he's also interesting because, you know, as a, just like the djinn, who's from the Middle East, but not Muslim, and how Salim has to deal with that. Matt Sweeney comes from, you know, after Spain and Italy, the most Catholic place in the world, right?
Sure.
Ireland. And so, but he's irreverent to all that, because his Ireland is not that Ireland. He basically got gentrified out of his spot, right? Nobody likes that.
Yeah, so, he mentioned Mother Church made him and the other gods small. So
exactly, and that's which is a great line considering the fact that we think of leprechauns as small, of elves as small, these little short little things, right? And you know, they chose this actor who's 6'5",
yeah,
to kind of give us this juxtaposition of what the church told us. And like when the church told us something, I mean us, the three of us, everybody listening,
sure,
you know, it's the church's narrative that has leprechauns, you know, sitting on a pot of gold in the corner, when what we learn is that he was basically a god king who saved an entire people and he from invasion or whatever, and that he had the power to take the treasure from the sun and give it to his people, right? That's a very different thing than sitting at the end of a rainbow in a pot of gold and kind of like stewing over it and trying to make sure nobody else gets it. So definitely small physically and small in terms of like small minded goals and stuff. So that was interesting to me. Andy, what are you feeling about Mad Sweeney?
Yeah. So, there's a couple things. First of all, you know, he said that the gray monks were changing the fair folk stories, making him the little green men. And I wasn't entirely sure who the gray monks were meant to be. I did a little...
the missionaries, man.
Is that what it is? Because I did a little research on the internet, and the closest thing I could find were... There was an order of missionaries known as the Terenesian Order, who came from France and eventually spread out into Wales and Ireland and England, and they were known as the Grey Monks. And he said that in one story, a monk called St. Moling had killed Sweeney that night, but that story may not be true. Bilquis heard a different story that Sweeney had a wife, and we get into like another part of his backstory where this is post going mad, where he's destitute and scrounging for food, and he's discovered in the woods by Yirin, his wife, and Moira, his daughter, and his madness makes him not remember them.
Yeah, he falls pretty far, huh? Yeah. So he goes from being this god king and dancing with his wife, you know, newlywed in this yellow dress that he remembers with the red flowers on it, which just reminds you that it wasn't a Christian wedding, right? It reminds you that this wedding, you know, Christian wedding has a white dress.
Sure,
but
this is
pre-Christian. So the yellow dress with the lilies on it, he's this sun king kind of guy. And then he falls so far that he's eating ants out of a tree. Can't remember his daughter, can't remember his wife, and yet they come anyway. His wife comes anyway to care for him, even though he can't remember them, and he's clearly like mentally ill and dangerous. They could have left him and abandoned him in the woods, but something brought her back, and it's so tragic. And then you see how he gets there, and it's crazy.
Yeah. So, but he does remember her wedding dress. And she tells him that, you know, that he lost his lands, title, and people when they lost the war after Mad Sweeney abandoned the battlefield. So we learn that basically he's got this great regret, this great remorse of having given up the opportunity to battle these to to do justice on the battlefield, that everything was lost and he went mad.
On the battlefield, did he leave it because of the prophecy?
Yeah, he left it. We see this in another backstory, in an earlier backstory, when he first married when he was first married to Irin. He is about to walk away from this battle with the Grey Monks
on his side, yeah.
And his wife Irin, who's pregnant, who just pregnant, is convincing him to stay. He tells her the Grey Monks are going to ruin everything they touch. Irin tells him the world is changing and begs him to change with it for his family. And she tries to convince him to make alliances with the Grey Monks. And that's where he hears the bells tolling.
And he becomes furious because
yes,
those are Christian church bells. Those are the kinds of things that remind him that he's being removed, that his culture is
their
being
people is
diminished
being,
and lost.
Right. They're building churches on their pagan land. So he goes to confront the local bishop, and he spears one of his priests. And he believes that the bishop cursed him to die by the spear as a revenge. And then the following day, where he goes to do battle, he hears banshees on the battlefield, and he walks away from the battle before that curse, which he believes was
could happen to him.
Yeah, before that curse could come true.
So he's craven.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and I think that's the battle that he keeps asking, that he keeps telling Wednesday that Wednesday owes him. He owes him a battle. He owes him a chance to redeem himself.
Yeah. And I really, it felt to me as if he was owed a chance to die on the battlefield.
Yes.
Rather die a hero than persist for all these hundreds and hundreds of years as a coward.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Tosin, how are you feeling about Mad Sweeney? What do you see?
I like this vision of him as an ultimate warrior that we don't see.
Ultimate warrior, nice.
Yeah, where he's, you know, sprinting and lunging ahead of everyone and using the sphere as his sort of like power instrument of power. And I think it was really well depicted in that point, in that perspective. Of like with great power he has, but he's also, as we kind of covered, more human and afraid and runs away.
And it's interesting, like when did he materialize as a god, right? Like how did he go from human through legend into the godness, right? Because it's not
the god king,
right? He became the god king, and so he becomes a legend in his own time,
right?
And then because of his cowardliness or whatever, he's able to walk the earth looking for a battle to replace the one he abandoned. So it's a truly tragic story. It's like a new myth based on all the old ones, which, you know, I could see Neil Gaiman being very, very good at. So but to me, one of the biggest things was this idea that he didn't understand where the truth began and where the truth ended. And Ibis, who's recording, we said, from his memory, from Sweeney's memory, these stories, and Sweeney's like, well, I don't know what the truth is.
A storyteller does not concern themselves with the truth. Stories are truer than the truth. These are not literal constructs so much as imaginative recreations.
It really lays out to me something big. It's not just a thing for Mad Sweeney and his kind of craziness and his inability to remember. That's humanity in a nutshell, right? Like, we tell stories. It's what we do. And it's only recently that we began writing, that we began recording, that we began peer reviewing in science and using journalism to make sure that the history was told by multiple accounts so there's some semblance of it that gets it right. But the first thing you learn when you're a kid, you're doing your first research paper in fifth grade, is that there are differing accounts, the conflicting reports. And Ibis, in this like super quick and succinct way, lays out that the people telling these stories are not trying to not be truthful. They're trying to tell a truth that's beyond the facts.
Right.
And to me, that was pretty pretty salient, because it's salient because it just sticks out beyond just Sweeney to the entire show, and to what makes books exciting in the first place. The fact that they touch all of us and they say some truths about who we are.
Yes, this goes back to one of our other podcasts, Violent Delights, our Westworld podcast, where we actually discussed a very similar point to this, in that there is a movie from the early 60s called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And it's about a gunfight that happened in a Western town. And there's a great quote from that movie where there's some differing accounts of who shot who and who was the hero of this particular conflict. And the quote is, "When the legend becomes the fact, print the legend." So again, this goes back to this idea of Ibis,
like, is that
the stories are truer than the truth. These are not literal constructs as much as imaginative recreations. So nice. It's more important that the story contains contains the essence of the truth rather than an actual factual account of what happened.
Right, because the story is what lingers and carries on, yes. And it has to be a charismatic telling in order for people to carry it forward. So that's interesting. It to me also reminds me of this idea of the spirit of the law versus the letter of the law.
Yeah,
we know what's right, and it's the difference between the spirit and the letter, wherein people can find loopholes and get around things.
Right, right.
So
right.
That's a thing.
So we see a lot of that in the unreliable narration that is Mad Sweeney's history.
Exactly. Speaking of unreliable narration,
yeah.
Are you ready for the significant changes from the book?
Sure, yes.
Big thing, Mad Sweeney's death. They played around with us in the beginning where in the book he's just asleep. He dies under like a bridge and he's just a drunk and it's unclear how he died. Maybe drinking himself to death, which means he committed suicide. Here, the spear kills him. The spear is a pretty toxic thing, so he may not be coming back. The role of the spear, it's a whole new thing here. It's, you know, there was a side quest to get it to work. It's now something that you know, it's not just something that's being transported. Shadow's got to like watch it, and it's tied to the life force of Wednesday, which I think it was in the book too, but it just seems like it's done so in a new and different way. The role of the Horde. So now the spear is stuck in the Horde and Matt Sweeney's dead, so he can't get it out. That's definitely a new thing. And the role of Yggdrasil. So we know Yggdrasil is a thing. It's somewhere in Virginia in the book. And here it's in Cairo, and it's a giant. And it's not quite the tree it used to be. But there's also not the three women who are protecting it with the Waters of Life and all that other stuff that we've seen. Maybe that'll show up. But
right.
Yggdrasil has become its own thing in this story. And it's also interesting because it grows rapidly, but it's still not exactly like big enough to support a person yet. So it's all very interesting. But I think that where they're taking it is just really expanding on the book. And that's the differences.
All right, so that takes us to the next episode, which is going to be the season finale of season two of American Gods. We don't know what to expect. I haven't seen any trailers or anything about that. So
I have a feeling Easter won't be in it.
No, I think Easter's gone.
Easter's
Audi 5000.
Last year it ended on the Easter weekend.
You know, she...
This year.
She was upset because all of her bunnies got run over, so she's not coming back. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why you'd be upset about that, but I get it.
But where do you think, since we're so off the off track from the book at this point, I thought for sure we were going to see Lakeside this season. Where do you think this season is going to end?
Maybe Shadow has to escape after having killed Mad Sweeney. So he goes to Lakeside.
You think maybe we'll end at the very end with him escaping to Lakeside, and then
like
sets
Shadow,
up,
you should lay low now that you've killed Mad Sweeney. That kind of thing
sets up Lakeside for season three.
Yeah, and then you know, Sam Black Crow can show up again and kind of
right.
You know, take him.
Who knows? All right, so that is going to do it for us. Join us next week on The Dominant Paradigm when we talk about the last episode of American Gods Season 2 titled Moon Shadow.
Which is what Matt Sweeney was calling him right. toward the end of the episode, yeah.
And it also sort of alludes to Shadow and Laura Moon. The right. combination of those two. So maybe we'll see a little bit of that action going on. In the meantime, why don't we go around the table here. Dwayne, why don't you tell us where people can find your work online when you're not here talking about American Gods.
Check me out on Geeks of Doom. And then you can also check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. And yeah, those are the two best places to find me online. Tosin, what about you?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321 and other ramblings at geeksofdoom.com. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com or just do a Google search for Andrew Sorsini or Mr. Babyman, which is my show's social media handle. All of the other stuff you can find on the Geeks of Doom podcast network, where we do The Drill Down, which is our weekly tech podcast. And we also do Violent Delights, which is our podcast about Westworld, which is on hiatus until 2020. So until then, catch us next week when we talk about more American Gods, the final episode of season 2. And we'll see you guys next week.